I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Tomorrow marks the two-year anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. We might not even know Floyd's name if Darnella Frazier hadn't taken out her cell phone to record the last minutes of his life as Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin knelt on Floyd's neck, ignoring his pleas. She wrote on her Facebook page last year about the horrifying incident, saying, "I knew his life mattered. I knew that he was in pain. I knew he was another black man in danger with no power." Our guest Robert Samuels and Tolu Olorunipa set out to better understand who George Floyd was and about the America he lived in. Their book is My Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. They detail how Floyd's great-great-grandfather was swindled out of his wealth in the Jim Crow South, what it was like for Floyd growing up poor in segregated Houston with big dreams as a kid, surrounded by a loving family. He later struggled with drug addiction and served time in prison for armed robbery. In fact, he had moved to Minneapolis for a drug rehab program. Our guests join us today on Radio Times to talk about George Floyd's America and what it says about our America. And they are here with us here in our Philadelphia studios. Robert Samuels, National Political Enterprise reporter for The Washington Post. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And as I said, also with us, Tolu Olorunipa, and he's political enterprise and investigations reporter for The Washington Post. Nice to have you, Tolu, as well.
It's so great to be with you, Marty.
You know, I do want to talk about George Floyd, but it's hard to get past the fact that tomorrow is the second year anniversary, and one never knows the day before a horrific accident or terrible tragedy what is going to happen. But I'm curious, Robert, what are your thoughts today? What are you thinking about? What are you even feeling about?
Well, this morning I actually woke up and I had some time with myself to think about it. And I remember where I was last year. And we were traveling between Minneapolis and Washington, D.C., both of us. And that day I was at George Floyd Square just talking to people, seeing what was happening. I was hanging out with George Floyd's old roommate. And gunshots rang out. Oh. And at that point, you didn't know what to think. We talk about this in the book because it could have been a common neighborhood beef. It could have been something more serious because the world was so tense. And no police came because the area did not like calling the police. And so after 15 minutes or so, I stepped out and I started to continue reporting. And I remember, I can still remember my pad shaking. And I looked down the street, and there was the brother of another person who had been slain by the police named Dante Wright, who was walking down the street to pay his respects to George Floyd. And someone came up to him who was running a greenhouse, and he said, "Look at this area, this place, the soil of it has wood chips that come from the plywood of buildings that were boarded up after the riots, after the uprising. But now they're helping flowers grow. And that's what we do. We look at something and we make it new."
I mean, that's everything. What you just said there, that is everything all at once. How about for you, Tolu?
Well, I couldn't put it quite as eloquently as Robert did, but we were in Minneapolis last year, and I also think about 2 years ago and what the world was like on May 24th, 2020. We were in the middle of a pandemic. We were reporting on it. We were seeing how that pandemic was disproportionately affecting communities like the community that George Floyd came from. Places where people of color lived were being decimated by the pandemic and being decimated by the economic impact of the pandemic. We were trying to cover that in real time, but it wasn't until after George Floyd died that we really saw the ability of the country to grapple with systemic racism and what had been happening across a range of institutions, not only policing, but also criminal justice, also education, also housing, and obviously healthcare with the pandemic. And one of the things I look back on 2 years later, as we did a series about George Floyd's life, focusing on how systemic racism impacted it, and then wrote this book, His Name is George Floyd, expanding on that series, mm-hmm. is looking at how systemic racism did impact one person's life. And hopefully, as people read the book, they will be able to grapple not only with the 10 minutes of the video of George Floyd dying, but the 46 years that he spent mm-hmm. slowly dying and trying to live in America, trying to breathe in America. And that's one of the things we were able to find out in writing this book.
And again, we will get to that. You talk about trying to understand George Floyd's America, but this is our America, right, Robert? I mean, it's not like an America that's over there. It's the America we all live in.
Absolutely. When you read about George Floyd, and this was our experience learning about George Floyd, we saw so many people we knew. He had so many. He was the type of friend that everyone has who, when you think about him, you reflect and you think about the fun times, the times when he was a little hapless. But there was also something else. And that was the idea that before George Floyd met Derek Chauvin, the things that he faced and the struggles that he endured and that he had to persist through happened to so many Black Americans every day. And when we did the book, we wanted the world to understand and to see that if you were concerned about the systemic racism that revealed itself when George Floyd died, you should probably consider the life of him and other people who are like him.
Well, even going back several generations, Tolu, to a great-great-grandfather in North Carolina, he managed, you know, after the end of slavery, so to speak, to become a relatively wealthy man. But, you know, the system would not allow that.
Yeah,
a wealthy Black man in the South.
Oh, yes. That was one of the most surprising and interesting things about George Floyd's story was that in order to write his story, we needed to rewind the tape back to the 19th century, back to seven generations in his family, to his great-great-grandfather, who was born enslaved, was born in North Carolina, and received his freedom after the Civil War, and was able to very rapidly, according to that period, amassed quite a large amount of wealth.
He had
500 acres of land. Him and his large family worked the land. They were farmers. Everyone above the age of 8 was working on the farm, according to census records back then. But at the time, it was seen as anathema for someone who was Black to be so wealthy. So he was targeted by wealth, by white landowners, by white farmers, and all of his land was stolen and seized from him through unscrupulous business deals and tax fraud. And he was not able to transfer that wealth down. And one of the ways we build wealth in this country is through intergenerational wealth transfers, passing inheritances down. And George Floyd was not able to benefit at all from the industriousness of his great-great-grandfather. Instead, his grandparents, his great-grandparents all worked as sharecroppers, and they were poor, and he came into the world poor. And it was important for us to show how racism impacted his origin, because we see him come into the world, in the words of his mother, born with two strikes, Black and poor in America, and already behind and trying to catch up.
And Robert, growing up in Houston.
Absolutely. He grew up in a part of Houston that was its largest housing project called the CUNY Homes. The people there call it the Bricks. And that neighborhood was a segregated neighborhood because the government designed it to be that way. It was redlined. And because it was segregated, there was very little investment inside that neighborhood to help lift people out of poverty. And when you have those conditions, in addition to the disinvestment that came after jobs went overseas, it created a bit of an economic sand trap for folks who had to figure out how they're going to be able to provide for their families.
Well, and he's got this strong mother, Tolu, right? Who she's raising her children. She's working, living in poverty, living in this project, and also in this poor community. What kind of mom was she, and what kind of influence did she have on her children?
Yeah, people saw the video of Floyd dying, and they saw him crying out for his mother, who had departed and was dead at the time. But he was a mama's boy. She was someone who really loved her children and really tried to protect her children and instill in them the values that they would need to survive in America. She would tell them that they needed to speak the King's English and speak proper English, because she knew that people would stereotype them if they didn't speak proper English. She would try to make sure that they were respecting the police. When you saw George Floyd say, "Yes, sir," Mr. Officer. That was all a result of the lessons he learned from his mother, because she knew that in their community they were targeted by police as young black men, and that they needed to fly right and be incredibly careful so that they wouldn't end up being brutalized or being victimized by the police. She was someone who was really protective of her children, and George Floyd had her heart. He had her spirit. He was kind-hearted like she was. He was open like she was. And that's something that so many people told us, was that he was someone who was very much like his mother.
Well, and picking up on that and going to you, Robert, you interviewed some of his teachers in elementary school. He was a quiet kid. He was a pretty good student. He was pretty much on grade level in some of those early years.
In second grade, his second grade teacher, who spoke with us in the reporting of this, she told us that he was a pretty okay student. He liked to run and jump when he was outside because he was a child. Sure. But she pulled out the records. He was at grade level in math and reading, which is difficult if you're growing up in an under-resourced community. And the other thing she did is she pulled out a second grader's essay, which is not the longest thing in the world, but he talks about wanting to be a Supreme Court justice. And he has that dream after learning about Thurgood Marshall. And it's not just him having the dream. It was how he wrote about it. It was the fact that the grammar was right. The spelling was right. Second grade. And that showed the type of student and the type of ambitions that he had when he was young.
Well, and Tolu, that breaks my heart. I mean, here's a 7 or 8 year old little boy who has dreams. He's got some struggles, obviously, in the community that he grew up in. But, you know, the potential was there.
Yeah, he was a survivor from that early age. And the teacher who brought out those records, she wrote in her records the phone number of every household in her class. And one of the things next to George Floyd's mother's name was the word neighbor. And that signified that she could not afford a phone. And that showed the level of poverty that he grew up in. And despite that, he was on national benchmarks in second grade as he was going into third grade. But we did see, and we do document over the course of the book, how he fell behind, how as he grew taller and stronger and continued to attend underfunded schools, people told him, this school thing is not going to be the way you make it out of this community. Our schools are not well-funded. Our schools are not sending people to universities at the high rate that other schools are, but they're sending people to college sports programs, and you have the athletic ability to make it, so you should focus and concentrate on that. And that's the lesson that he got, and that's the lesson he took, and he really did put all of his efforts into athletics, but unfortunately, not having an education made it hard, even though he got a college scholarship to play in college because he couldn't meet his academic eligibility requirements. And that was another dream, like the dream of being a Supreme Court justice, that he's found himself running into a closed door as he tried to chase that dream.
And I do want to pick up on that, but let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Tolu Olorunipa, who joins us along with Robert Samuels, and they have co-authored a brand new book. It's called His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. Tomorrow marks the second year anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. We always want to hear from you on Radio Times. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. What are your thoughts this week as we remember what happened nearly 2 years ago in Minneapolis? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Tolu Olorunipa, political enterprise and investigations reporter for The Washington Post, Robert Samuels, national political enterprise reporter for The Washington Post, and both co-authors of this new book. His name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. You quote, I'll go back to you, Robert, George Floyd, when he would enter a room, he would shake everyone's hand, and his explanation was, people look at me and get nervous. I'm telling them I'm a good person. He's 6'6". He weighs eventually, I guess, over 200 pounds. Being a big black man, How did people view him? What was he seen as?
Well, this is one of the cruelest contradictions of his life. And I just want to go back to something Tolu said, because I want listeners to understand that because of his size and his speed, people thought football more than Supreme Court justice, right? And when that dream doesn't come to fruition, he was a lanky man who built himself up so he could play football. What he was left with was a size and a silhouette that, if you were not on the football field, felt threatening and intimidating to people. And he built his life around that contradiction.
Yeah.
So when he'd go into rooms, he'd often shake people by the hand, like you said. He always wanted to tell people he loved them. We talk about that a lot in the book. And he talks about this discomfort. It's this daily reminder of his own self and his own shortcomings, that he had this body that was built to do this thing, and he never got to do it.
And his coach, Tolu, you know, when he was playing football, said, you know, here's this big guy, be aggressive. He was not aggressive on the football field. That was a problem his coach had with him.
Yeah, the coach didn't know what position to put him at, because he's tall, he's skinny and lanky, but he's not aggressive. He's not someone who is a punisher on the football field. He's instead someone who's a jokester, but also is just not playing the kind of aggressive football that the team played. And that was something that was part of that contradiction that Robert mentioned. You know, he's tall, he's big, but at the same time, he's not someone who's a brawler. He's not someone who's going to use his size to exploit other people. And that's one of the things that made his death so tragic. That's why he tried to tell the officers, I'm not a bad guy. Why don't you believe me? I'm not that type of guy, because he knew that his body presented a certain stereotype, while he, in his personality, presented a much different stereotype and a much different type of personality. And that was part of the reason why he had that contradiction throughout the course of his life.
So he goes to college for a couple of years, Robert, and doesn't make it, frankly. So here he is. He's not going to have a career at the NFL. He's not particularly well-educated. So what options does he have in this part of Houston where his family lives?
Well, that's the question he's asking himself. And he eventually gives into the economics of the neighborhood, which at that time was the drug trade. And people who knew George Floyd, they told us that his heart was never in it. He had never anticipated being that. He had never wanted to do that. But he was in a place where he could not get a job. And he had a family back at home. His mother was falling ill. His sister needed additional help with her children. And he wanted to find a way to help make some money for the house.
So he was selling drugs and using drugs, it sounds like, as well.
Yeah. So along the course, people start getting concerned, because he starts seeming more erratic. Mm-hmm. And he develops a drug dependency issue, yes.
Well, and just to put this into some context, Tolu, we've got Richard Nixon's war on drugs. We've got Ronald Reagan essentially pulling the rug out under a lot of safety net programs. So people like George Floyd, who need help, are in trouble in certain kind of ways. What's there for them?
Not much. And there was a time where George Floyd admitted, after he was arrested, that he had a substance use issue. He wrote on intake forms that he was abusing Percocet and abusing other drugs. And he asked for help. He asked for mental health support. And he was told at the time by the Texas prison where he was that he was faking a mental illness. And this was a time when Texas prisons were actually trying to rein in their budget, because mass incarceration had cost them so much. And instead of, you know, slowing down the mass incarceration and slowing down the arresting and imprisoning people for nonviolent drug offenses, they decided to make budget cuts and make it much less expensive for them to imprison the same number of people, which meant fewer services, less rehabilitation, less in the form of mental health support. So George Floyd spent his time in prison, even when he admitted that he needed help, not getting any support, and eventually getting some of the issues that he faced later in life, from claustrophobia to mental health distress.
And this was a time, Robert, when people talked about super predators, right?
Right.
This was the 90s.
Right. And this goes back to a history from the beginnings of black people entering in the United States, that there were false studies, junk science, that looked at their bodies, our bodies, and came up with these ideas that we could be threatening, super strong if we're upset, and thus needed harsher punishment. And so when the drug crisis started to happen, when the opioid crisis hit urban communities, the thought that was coming from the federal government on down was not a thought about how can we rehabilitate these people? What are they running away from? Why are they using? The thought was we needed to protect society from them because they might be dangerous. Now, we talked about George Floyd's personality before, but given the time and their response to him, people were uninterested in actually listening and believing him when he said he had these kinds of issues.
I mean, he served time for armed robbery. That's a serious crime. I mean, I guess there, as you write about it, there's some question about exactly his involvement in what happened. But nonetheless, Tolu, he pleaded guilty.
Yes, he pled guilty to that crime and actually pled guilty 8 times over the course of his life. He never faced a jury, in part because he felt in cases where he would have the chance to present his side of the story before a jury that a jury wouldn't believe him. He couldn't afford a lawyer in the armed robbery. He told friends at the time that he had not been the gunman in that robbery, but he did not feel like he was going to get a fair shake at trial. He knew he was going to face up to 40 years. So all of his friends who believed him when he told them that he wasn't the gunman, they told him to plead guilty even though they felt he was innocent, even though he said he was innocent, because a 5-year guilty plea is much more something that you can stomach than a 40-year conviction. And he was presented with that choice and decided to plead guilty. And that's part of the justice system that he faced, which is a system that doesn't always seem fair to people like him, people who are black, people who are poor, who can't afford lawyers. And one of the things we document is that he was stopped over 20 times in his life, including by 6 officers that were later charged with crimes of their own. And some of them were charged with falsifying arrests. So even though he admitted to some of his crimes, he admitted that he was guilty. In some cases, he said he was not guilty. But every time, when it was the state of Texas versus George Floyd, he pled guilty and he served time behind bars for a number of different offenses.
And if I could just jump in here with one other thing, because I think it's important, because I know a lot of your listeners might say, well, doesn't the system work like this? Like, even if you're poor, you can get a lawyer. What we go through in the book is that the lawyers who are appointed in Texas, they were often doing this as second jobs. They didn't take these things seriously. So there was no guarantee that there'd be someone who'd be willing to defend George Floyd seriously.
And if I can jump in.
Go ahead.
You know, a lot of people ask, did you interview the pregnant woman that he held at gunpoint?
Right.
And as part of this reporting, we did include an interview with the victim in the case. And she said that she was not sure whether or not it was George Floyd who was the gunman. She had the choice of choosing certainty, uncertainty, or tentative assurance that this was the person at the time. And she chose tentative. And years later, she continued to have doubts about whether or not it was George Floyd who was the man who had robbed her. So it was important for us to include the full story, and we hope people read this part of the book because we go into it pretty extensively.
Yes, yes, indeed you do. You also say for a convicted felon in Texas, there are a lot of what's left, I guess, what was left of the safety net programs, a lot of them not available, right, Robert, that you couldn't get food stamps or you couldn't get hired, you couldn't get a job.
Absolutely. You could not get a host of professional licenses. If George Floyd wanted to be a barber, he could not have been a barber in Texas. If he wanted to have food stamps to help support his family, he could not get that either because he had the felony conviction. He could not get a job. And so it's a question, again, about what sort of things and what sort of response do we have to those who might have had a chemical dependency issue, like George Floyd said he had, and what you can do for those who have done their time and they want to rehabilitate their lives. In Texas, there was not a lot for him to do.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That is Robert Samuels, also with us, Tolu Olorunipa, and they have co-authored a new book. His name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. And as always on Radio Times, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always pick up the phone. Give us a call, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. And this week, in fact, tomorrow marks the second anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. Let me quote something from your book, and this is where he's released from prison. You know, he's trying to figure out his life, doesn't have a lot of options. He was the older brother, but he was the one in the most precarious financial situation. He was the one with a lengthy criminal record, the Percocet cravings, the child support lawsuits. As he got on his bus to head back to Houston just weeks shy of his 43rd birthday, he had to deal with the reality that he had become something he had so desperately wanted to avoid, an unemployed man who lived with his mother and spent his days hanging out on the corner. It's a heartbreaking couple of sentences there, Tolu.
Yeah, and it contrasts with earlier in the book where we talk about the ambitious George Floyd who tells his sister, I don't want to rule the world. I don't want to run the world. I just want to touch the world. He had ambitions. He had dreams. And as he's 43 years old with a criminal record and with a number of different issues that we get into in the book, he's looking back and assessing his life and realizing that he's not where he wants to be. And this is just shortly before he decides he's going to pack up his things, leave behind the community and the family that he knew and try to get a fresh start in Minneapolis. It's why he leaves Houston, his hometown, for Minneapolis to get into a rehab program, to get work, to get a job, to try to be a better father, to try to be a better provider for his family. And he had to square this situation that he was looking at himself in the mirror and saying, I'm not where I want to be. And that's what we want as a society for people who are struggling to say, I'm going to do things differently. And unfortunately, we know he met his end in Minneapolis, but he went there to try to get a fresh start.
To get help. Robert, was his family frustrated with him?
They wanted the best for him, like any family would. And when he went to seek help, they were incredibly supportive of it. Now, they loved George Floyd, and by the accounts of one of his nephews, Brandon, who spoke with us over the course of more than a year, he'd tell these stories about how George Floyd would make sure he was going to school, how he'd drill him for having layups if he missed one in a game. So they wanted the best for him.
He goes to Minneapolis, and you describe that really interesting rehab program that's really tailored to African Americans, and maybe more African American men than women, I'm not sure, but looking at the stressors of poverty and of racism and how that can show up. And I wonder, Tolu, if you could talk about the philosophy and what this organization was trying to do.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons George Floyd left Houston for Minneapolis was because there was this pipeline of people who had left Houston for rehab programs in Minneapolis. And one of the rehab programs that was popular was called Our Turning Point. It was run by black men for black men, and it was tailored to the kinds of stressors that black men face, not only addiction, not only issues related to substance use, but also resources, also the fact that their bodies are often seen as a threat, often the fact that they face racism, and that can exhibit itself in health outcomes as people stress out over being discriminated against. We see it in the literature that there's social science, physical health outcomes as a result of people experiencing racism. And all
cortisol,
of that,
right?
Yes, yeah. Higher and heightened cortisol levels. And all of that was incorporated into this rehab program, which George Floyd was a part of. It was a place where he opened up about his anxieties and his disappointment. And it was a place where he was actually experiencing a better experience, a better time in his life in early 2017, where he was getting clean, he had a job, he was in love and was in a relationship, and there was this period of time where things were going well for him. But as we report in the book, and Robert can talk about this because he did a lot of these interviews, everything came crashing down on him and he fell back into his addiction.
Yeah, he lost a friend, a roommate, right?
Yeah, and I just want to go back. The interesting thing about cortisol, when we think about how we hope George Floyd's story reflects all of our stories, is that the raises in stress hormones that you typically see in black people that cuts across socioeconomic lines, educational lines, income lines. The stress of being black in America can make you sick. Now, when George Floyd comes out of this program, he's doing super well. Mm.
It's a very strict program.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And he's doing super well. He's clean. He gets two jobs. He starts trying to get a commercial truck driving license. And he gets this really nice townhouse in a pretty part of Minneapolis called St. Louis Park. It overlooks some nice waters. It has a lot of fancy stores. There are cops who say hello to him, which was very weird for him. And he moves in with a friend named Eric, who was in the program with him. And they were very similar, both large men, both very friendly, both used to play sports, had some time in college. And a few months into them living there, he walks in, George Floyd walks in, and he sees his friend on the couch unconscious, and he's cold. And it turns out his friend had overdosed. Mm. And that was the beginning for George Floyd to realize that he could not simply escape some of these larger issues by simply moving from state to state. They were going to follow him. And dealing with that yields another set of consequences and another set of troubles that he tried to encounter and tried to persevere through throughout the course of his life.
Well, again, quoting you from your book, and this is where he's living in this more sort of upscale, largely white neighborhood with white neighbors who were his age. They were thriving. They had nice pets and kids and, you know, kids that did well in school and all that. And as you say, police officers that would say hello. In his, I guess, previous neighborhood, people were beginning to die. Friends were dying by suicide, succumbing to cancer, having heart attacks, overdosing, dying in the sleep, being shot and killed. Back in Houston, the names of these lost friends and acquaintances were scribbled on markers and spray paint. This sort of two diametrically to opposed worlds in many ways.
Yeah, and George Floyd was hundreds of miles away trying to get his life together, but he was getting calls back from Houston about friends dying, and it was difficult for him to remove himself from his home. And one of the calls that he received in 2018 was pretty close to home. He received information that his mother, someone who was he was so close to, had passed away, and she passed away before he was able to come back to Houston and be with her and see her and speak to her. And they had always been so close. He had felt somewhat guilty about leaving her behind because she had a number of health issues to move to Minneapolis. And everyone we spoke to said that when his mother died, shortly after his roommate died, it just completely broke him. He just got completely consumed by the grief associated with that loss, and it was something that he never recovered from. It was something that he struggled with for all of the rest of his life.
We are talking about George Floyd, talking with the authors of a brand new book. His name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. We have much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Wednesday this week marks the second anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. Talking with our guests today on Radio Times, Tolu Olorunipa and Robert Samuels. Again, they are reporters for The Washington Post and co-authored this new book. His name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. We've covered a fair amount of George Floyd's life. Any questions or comments, you can certainly send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Robert, did George Floyd and Derek Chauvin, did they work at the same club?
This is one of the mysteries and lingering rumors that we're trying to nail down. So it is true that Derek Chauvin, he moonlighted at a club called El Nuevo Rodeo in Minneapolis. It is said that George Floyd occasionally worked there. And there were some rumors and people who came in and gave sworn statements to prosecutors about the two of them knowing each other. However, no prosecutor, and not in our reporting, could we ever confirm that they did know each other. There's every reason to believe that when they saw each other that day, they would not have recognized each other.
Well, let's talk about that day, May 25th, 2020, Tolu. And George Floyd goes into this local grocery store. What happens?
Well, first, just to the previous question about whether they knew each other, one of the things that readers will find out in this book was that whether or not Derek Chauvin knew George Floyd, it was very common for him to use the tactics that he used. So there was no need.
The knee.
Yes, the neck restraint, the knee on the neck. There was no need for him to have personal animosity towards Floyd to use this, because we go into his history and we go into his experience and we see that he had used the same restraint on children, on older men. It was something that he did regularly, and he did it against George Floyd in a fatal way.
And just one quick follow-up. Was that approved, allowed by the Minneapolis Police Department?
He had been trained to use the neck restraint. It was not obviously supposed to be a fatal use of force. It was actually supposed to be something that could be used in lieu of fatal force to subdue someone but to not kill them. But Derek Chauvin had a reputation of being excessive in his use of this restraint and in his use of force. And he had used it in ways that were quite violent and led to a number of injuries for people. He had never killed anyone with it before until he met George Floyd, and he showed that this restraint could be deadly.
Yeah.
And just to answer the other question,
sure,
about May 25th, 2020, George Floyd thought that that day would be a day that he spent with friends, did some errands, and ended the day with a barbecue with one of his friends who lived on the north side of the city. But as he entered into Cup Foods with one of his friends and met up with another friend, he was alleged to have used a counterfeit $20 bill, and the police were called. And what could have been a fine or a ticket quickly escalated as the police came up to him, pulled out a gun, and then tried to arrest him and tried to get him into the back of the squad car. And we saw what happened on a number of different videos, that what could have easily been handled in a less violent way became a violent arrest and became a deadly interaction. And we saw what happened afterward with the racial justice movement that sparked from it. But this all could have ended in a very different way.
How long did it take you to, Robert, to look at this tragic video?
I'll be honest, Marty, it wasn't until the trial for Derek Chauvin that I ever looked at the video in full. And the reason why was, when we first started this reporting, we wanted to make sure that the people we spoke to knew we were serious about wanting to learn about George Floyd's life, not his death. And so I had avoided it until I needed to watch it. And when I watched it, it was when they first entered it into evidence, and they played it from several different angles. One of the things that we do in the reporting of this is we wanted the readers to understand what this might have looked and felt like in the community. And so we talked to a number of people in the community who were there that day, who lived in the neighborhood. And one of the really interesting things is that if you saw this through the lens of Darnella Frazier's video, you saw something that was horrifying to you. But if you were not in front of it, the screams, the struggle with the police seemed as commonplace at that area. It would have not struck you as being unusual. And I think that says something that's terrifying to think about, and also a sad, uncomfortable truth about how police operate within neighborhoods with large black populations.
So if you hadn't, and, you know, I think most people have seen it by now. I mean, the thing that struck me, there are many things that struck me about that video, but was the look on Derek Chauvin's face of indifference or arrogance or a kind of smugness, or, and people were saying, you're killing him, essentially, and he didn't move.
Right. You had George Floyd begging for his life, saying, I can't breathe, saying, my stomach hurts, saying, what you're doing is cold-blooded, crying out for his life. Even crying out for his mother. And you also had people who are bystanders crying out on George Floyd's behalf when he was no longer able to speak for himself, saying, get off of him, he can't breathe, move your knee. And Derek Chauvin had no kind of emotional response to these cries for mercy. And as we investigated his background, we saw that that was his nature. That was how he behaved as a police officer, saying it's protocol when people said, you don't need to use that much force, being quite robotic and unemotional in some of these instances, even though, you know, the human side of any of us would say, if somebody is underneath you crying for their mother and crying that they can't breathe, maybe you give them a little bit of relief. And even some of the other officers were like, maybe we should turn him on his side. And he said, no, we've got an ambulance coming. We're just going to stay here. And, you know, being that way as a police officer is part of the reason why there's so much distrust between different communities and the police, because when mercy is needed, instead there's the answer, this is protocol. This is exactly what you do under this situation. This is how we've been trained. And unfortunately, it led to a death. And now Derek Chauvin is behind bars because of what he did.
Yeah, convicted of murder. No, yeah, go ahead, Robert.
I just want to be clear about one thing. Derek Chauvin and his lawyer, even though we asked several times, including several direct emails to Officer Chauvin himself, did not participate in the project. And we tried speaking with more than 100 people who had known him, some of whom worked with him, many of whom were unable to talk on the record. So we don't fully know what was going on in Derek Chauvin's head, right, except for the fact that when he is asked by a bystander on the street what's going on, he says, we need to subdue him because he's a big guy. George Floyd was 6'6", Derek Chauvin was 5'9". But when we went and we looked at the other records and the other reports that Derek Chauvin had written for the several times that he had used the neck restraint, which was a disproportionate amount, he accounted for 3% of the use of this particular hold for the entire Minneapolis Police Department, which has 900 people. So it's a lot. There are several instances in which he says he uses this restraint because the person is bigger than him.
You mentioned something, Robert, and I just want to make sure I understand it. So we know the video, you know, the one, I guess, that I quoted at the top of the show, but you're saying from other angles, it looked like what, business as usual in
right.
this neighborhood?
So this, I mean, and this is something that we thought it was important for folks to understand, that when you were there, if you saw this in front of you, it looked terrifying. But when you'd go to other people's houses and you'd talk to them across the street and you'd say, what did you hear? They'd say, well, this sort of thing happens all the time. We didn't hear anything strange because they could not see it. What they heard, the commotion from the public, from the community, telling a police officer this is too much, is something that is not uncommon in that neighborhood.
You know, in response, Tulu, there were worldwide protests about the protesting against what happened to George Floyd. Where is that now, 2 years later? And a lot has been written about in where that movement, such as it was, where it went.
There was a sense in the summer of 2020 that people were coming together in the way that they hadn't before. You had suburban voters, you had Republicans, you had people who had been resistant to the Black Lives Matter movement in the past say that what happened to George Floyd was unequivocal. This should not have happened. It's not a debatable use of force. This was wrong, and we needed to take to the streets in the middle of a pandemic and push against it. 2 years later, we now see that there has been a backlash to that coming together. There's been a backlash to the idea that we should be discussing racial justice issues. There's been a backlash to the idea that we should teach about this country's history. Critical race theory has become this flashpoint in our politics. And there are people that are winning elections, essentially, by publishing and pushing on the backlash to George Floyd in the summer of 2020. And we've seen progress in this country be in fits and starts. It always happens to have a backlash, and that's what we're going through now. There have been some changes. There have not been the major changes that people thought would happen after George Floyd died, but it's an ongoing struggle. We're living history, and that's one of the reasons we wanted to write this book, was because this is happening live. This is a first and second draft of history that is still unfolding and taking place before our eyes.
Does it feel like justice? So, Robert, that Derek Chauvin is in prison. He was found guilty of murder in prison, I think, for 22 years. The other police officers at the scene have been found guilty of civil rights violations. Does that feel like justice?
The person to ask whether it feels like justice isn't me, but the families of George Floyd and the people who knew him well. And they'll tell you that there is accountability, and we're glad they were glad that there was accountability. And there's also been a continual question about what justice can feel like if you cannot get your brother back, if you cannot get your best friend back. And I think that's one of the things, you know, I had dinner with the family on the day they received a $27 million settlement from the Minneapolis Police Department. And that was probably the cruelest $27 million you could ever receive. And
did they see it that way?
Yes. That's not my interpretation.
That's not you. That's them. That.
And, you know, as they're eating, they'd say, oh, I don't even know how to process this. How can you reduce a man to dollars and cents, no matter the amount of money? And I remember Rodney Floyd, George Floyd's brother, saying, I wish my mom were here so we could just give it to them. The idea of pain and plunder that started with his great-grandfather still rings true. And so they were taught to not value money. And so when we think about this, I think it's really important to remember that what they wanted most when they talked about it, what Philonis Floyd would say and had said to me, was they wanted to make sure that a police officer, if they encountered someone who looked like George Floyd, would not even think about doing something like this again. And unfortunately, that has not borne fruit.
Well, let me play George Floyd's niece, Brooke Williams. She spoke at his funeral service. This was Houston on June 9th, 2020. Let's give that a listen.
Hello, my name is Brooke Williams, George Floyd's niece, and I can breathe. Long as I'm breathing, justice will be served for Perry. First off, I want to thank all of you for coming out to support George Perry Floyd. My uncle was a father, brother, uncle, and a cousin to many. Spiritually grounded and activist, he always moved people with his words. Their officer showed no remorse while watching my uncle's soul leave his body. He begged and pleaded many times just for you to get up, but you just pushed harder. Why must this system be corrupt and broken? Laws were already put in place for the African-American system to fail. And these laws need to be changed. No more hate crimes, please. Someone said, make America great again. But when has America ever been great?
Tolu, I mean, it's just heartbreaking to hear her voice, obviously, and what she's saying as well. How's the family doing?
Yeah, that pain still lingers. That's the pain of a family that lost a loved one, a pain of a family that has lost so much over the generations going back 200 years. And that's a pain that you hear in her voice, and the pain of someone mourning the loss of someone who was beloved, who was a big figure within his family, within his community. And 2 years later, there's still that pain. There's still that sorrow. You know, we don't speak for the family, and it's a large and diverse family with different people processing their pain in different ways. Some have been more active and more public. Some have been more private. We're grateful that so many of them, even the private individuals, spoke to us for this book. They do want his memory to be honored. They do want his legacy to be civil rights legislation and changes that Brooke Floyd talked about. They want there to be massive changes, and they want there to be changes that would actually impact what happens in the future. And I should have said Brooke Williams, but we want there to be, she wants there to be changes that take place and that continue for years, and so that people do not experience what her uncle experienced from the police.
Robert Samuels, we're almost out of time here, but this is our America, right?
Absolutely. When people read this book, we want them to understand that there was a persistence about George Floyd, about the way he did his life. We were very conscientious that we did not want to write a book simply about pain and pity in the black experience. That's not the full story. But I think the question that as people rip through, as people go through the pages, that we want them to start thinking about is whether or not they would have believed George Floyd when he said, "Why don't you believe me?" And to begin to do the emotional excavation to help build a better society and a fairer society.
We have to leave it there. Thank you for writing this book.
Thanks so much for having us.
And thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. Really important conversation. And again, our guests have been Robert Samuels, Tulu Olarinipa. I did get it, right?
Yes.
Olarinipa. And their book is titled, His Name is George Floyd, and they are both reporters with the Washington Post. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Betzler. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.